evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Kim Nash. On today's show, a special broadcast.
Still largely out of public view are the concerns of residents, students, and at least 40,000 workers at Ground Zero exposed to poisonous air toxins. The workers who labored under unsafe conditions. $20 billion were pumped into New York City by the federal government that went to line the pockets of corporations, supposedly to keep them in the downtown area, while the working victims of the Trade Center disaster were left to fend for themselves. Well, we will continue to examine the exploitation and callousness in the redevelopment of Ground Zero that has led to one of the worst occupational disasters in American history. And joining us now are Joel Kufferman, who is with the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project, and Dr. Jacqueline Moline with the World Trade Center Monitoring and Treatment Center at Mount Sinai Medical Center.
Dr. Moline, the Sinai Medical Center recently released a report which really knocked my socks off. I mean, the figures were much, much higher than, even though I've been following this for a while, and certainly you have, than I had anticipated. Tell us about this most recent report by the Mount Sinai Medical Center on the World Trade Center cleanup and recovery.
Well, this study reported on approximately 9,500 workers and volunteers who were seen in our clinical centers in the New York, New Jersey area from July 2002 to April 2004. People were seen for a free comprehensive evaluation, and in that they had breathing tests, they had a chest x-ray, they had blood and urine tests, and they had a comprehensive examination and history taken. What we found was that 70% of patients had some symptoms while they were working at the World Trade Center site, and of that, 60% of people still had symptoms at the time of their examination, which might have been up to 2.5 years after the event. The numbers certainly were staggering for respiratory and upper respiratory symptoms that just were so prevalent and so persistent. We also found that fully a third of our patients had abnormal breathing tests. So that's much higher than would be expected, and this was seen in non-smokers as well as smokers, but the rates, when we compare our non-smoking population in our project to non-smoking rates, the rates for one particular test was 5 times what we would have expected. So we have objective evidence that can show decreases in lung function, and that may be why so many people feel short of breath at this time.
This is for both the rescue workers during the disaster itself and for cleanup workers, recovery workers?
Correct. This is for people who were down there from September 11th on through when the site was closed. Over 70% of our patients were there during the first 2 to 3 days. So the vast majority of our population, I think actually it was about 84%, were there either from September 11th through 14th. And then the rest of the people may have come on at some point over the next few weeks. The vast majority of people were there through October 1st, and many of them were there for up to 9 or 10 months. But we, in our population, in our patient population, we have police officers, we have construction workers, we have people restoring essential services like transportation, Con Edison, people in the Communication Workers Union, the cleaners of the site around the area. What we weren't allowed to include in our study were the neighboring residents and people involved in the dust cloud or building reoccupants. We do have people who were cleaning the buildings are part of our study, but not those who worked in the area and went back to their jobs.
Joel, I think most people in New York remember that Whitman, the then head of the Environmental Protection Agency, and also Giuliani didn't protest about this, said that the area is clean, don't worry about it.
He said it quite a few times.
So what's your reaction to all of this, and also what do you think is the culpability of the federal and the city government toward making people's lives whole at this point?
Well, we've been concentrating on the federal level. I'm co-counsel on a case called Benzman versus Whitman and the EPA with a firm called Bergen Montague, that we basically charged Whitman with violating the Fifth Amendment of all those residents, students, workers that were brought into the zone of danger. Chrissy Todd Whitman claimed something called qualified immunity, saying as a government official, you can't touch me. And the judge said, sorry, you're wrong. Your behavior was so egregious that it shocks the conscience. And now we're in Second Circuit Court of Appeals, waiting for her appeal.
Dr. Moline, let's talk money. I know that the federal government, last year I believe it is, kicked in about $100 million to help with the testing. What exactly is going on in terms of trying to help both to test people and also to treat people at this point?
In 2004, a total of about $80 million was appropriated for all the monitoring programs, including the fire department, including money that went to the health registry, and money that went to programs that are coordinated from Mount Sinai but include Queens College, NYU Bellevue, UMDNJ in New Jersey, and SUNY Stony Brook. And that was within that initial for the monitoring. This was to have people come back for follow-up evaluations and also to continue to enroll new patients. That money came in 2004. In December of this past year, Congress reappropriated about $75 million that was earmarked for treatment. Of that $75 million, only about $52 million of that is actually going to be going directly to treatment. Some money is going to other places. And that money is actually going to be made fully available over the next month or so. So there have been resources to do the screening and monitoring of the workers, but until very, very recently, there's been no federal money for treatment. We at Mount Sinai and other institutions have been very lucky with the generosity of philanthropy, and particularly recently the American Red Cross has stepped up and provided the funds for all of us to have treatment monies and treatment programs, and we have a very active treatment program at Mount Sinai. Unfortunately, the need outstrips or the demand outstrips our available resources at present, and we're hoping the federal funds will allow us to expand the program.
Joel, there were $20 billion that were appropriated by the federal government. Is none of this money being used for treatment, for helping the workers who became sick as first responders or in cleaning up the situation?
Just some of the money is beginning to be spent, but I do know that quite a bit of that money is being spent on legal defense for the insurance captive fund, which is basically money that was set aside originally to compensate workers and to get them treatment, but that money is being spent at lawyers at up to $500 an hour to defend the city.
And Joel, you and I were speaking before, and it's kind of a bittersweet, well, I feel vindicated. vindicated because we've known it's the most common reality that There had to be long-lasting consequences that would shorten people's lives. Those of us who lived in the outer boroughs could barely breathe for weeks after from the cyanotic-type smell that was permeating the entire region, really. How is it that it is now 5 years later that this winds up being some kind of a revelation? I have a father who died of mesothelioma because he worked with asbestos. We understand about occupational safety and health. We know what toxicity is. What in heck's name happened there, aside from Whitman and Giuliani playing the blame game 5 years later?
I think there was a paralysis of reason. We went down there. It was a cop, a union delegate, a good union delegate that worked for PBA, that called me up and said, Joel, you helped us out when they sprayed us with malathion. You got to help us again. Some of my cop and my delegation are spitting up blood. What can you do? And I said, get me down there. And he did. And we just grabbed samples and put them into a little plastic bag. We sent them out to a lab, and we came up with 5% asbestos and 90% fiberglass in one sample, right in front of the post office building. And at the time, we kept on hearing Giuliani and Whitman saying that, you know, things were safe. And so what we did is we FOIA'd Freedom of Information Act, the federal, the state, and the city. The feds provided documents fairly quickly. The state took 83 days on the grounds that there was ongoing criminal investigation, and the city took longer. And in those figures alone, in those statements that gave us in 600 pages, they told us that 97 samples taken, 71 were analyzed, and 26 cannot be analyzed because the filters became clogged. They told us it was PCBs, dioxins, and the like. But that was in documents that were never published, that never made it to their website. On their website, they said that a few went above the 1%, failing to tell us that it was above 5%. We were, frankly, you know, shocked that no one else out there was saying anything. And we were told over and over again, I and Juan Gonzalez, we turned over these documents to Juan. He did more investigation and came up with a famous toxic nightmare page. And over again, we were told that we were alarmists. We're just alarming the people. And then a smear campaign was underway. And it took me a little while to realize that they didn't say that we were wrong. They just said that we were alarming people.
And doctor, again, I was looking at pieces of the study, and it said that there was dust that contained innumerable tiny shards of glass, which would get lodged in the lungs in a stew of toxic and carcinogenic substances like asbestos and dioxin. How do you feel? What was your perception of the politics and the pain of fighting against this failure to recognize just how disastrous what had happened environmentally was to be?
Well, you know, in occupational medicine, we're confronted with situations like this in many respects quite often, which is if people don't know the answers, I think that they tend to minimize. And I think there's often the urge to do that. And what we find is, in fact, you can't minimize these things because the health consequences can be severe. In this particular instance, there was no question in any of our minds from the first day, frankly, that there were going to be issues and health effects related to the fallout from the buildings. Literally, you had the collapse of 220 stories of concrete and glass, and combined with the fires and all the compounds in there, you had really a toxic brew that was unprecedented. And I think so much initial focus was on the long-term health effects, which frankly are long-term and wasn't going to affect anyone's health right then and there, that we lost sight of the fact, or we as a general community, that there were going to be acute health effects. And we didn't do enough to protect people who were working down there. And it was, you know, when we look back, it was all, let's get back to business. But frankly, you know, there could have been and there should have been a lot more attention paid to protecting the workers on the pile who had the highest exposure. And then decisions that were made to repopulate Lower Manhattan, in hindsight, I think, were not based on health reasons. There were other reasons behind it. And as a physician, obviously, they're quite frustrating to me.
The Pataki administration finally, 5 years after, signed the workers' comp bill extending the deadline so that these workers, when they found out that they were sick, could apply for workers' comp. And Bloomberg finally said that if people don't have medical insurance, they can go to Bellevue Hospital. Is this enough? What more needs to be done?
They're all steps in the right direction. And, you know, finally we're seeing action from Governor Pataki, and that's a wonderful thing. And maybe it'll make it so that workers' comp for all workers, not just those affected by 9/11, will be a little easier, because the system is intensely frustrating from the patient standpoint as the doctor trying to get treatment for the patients. And that, you know, finally some resources are being given to residents and office reoccupants in Lower Manhattan. You know, it's been very frustrating for us not to be able to include people who were certainly affected but didn't meet the parameters of workers or volunteers in our medical monitoring programs or our treatment programs. So, I mean, I'm very pleased that those resources, at least they're starting to come. Certainly not enough. And there's going to be more that needs to be done for everyone. But, you know, at least things are moving. After 5 years, it may have taken those 5 years. Finally, we're getting some action. It should have been years earlier, but again, I'd like to be positive about this and say we're going in the right direction now.
Unfortunately, Mrs. Joel, I'm a little on the negative side, because supposedly we learned lessons from 9/11. And if you look what happened in the Gulf Coast and Katrina, we repeated the same mistakes. We had high levels of benzene. We had dangerous exposure rates. And the EPA again came down and said these are not dangerous conditions.
And what are the responsibility of the federal government, the $20 billion that they poured in, how much of that has gone for the workers at the site, and how much more needs to be devoted to it?
Well, from the medical aspect of it, there's been probably a total of about $150 million to all the workers and volunteers at the site has been committed. I mean, that's a drop in the bucket when you're thinking $20 billion and when you're thinking this is not going to meet the health care needs. It's certainly, you know, it gives us enough funding for all our programs to last for another 2.5 years. for monitoring, and I don't think we're going to even have a year's worth of money for the treatment program. I mean, medical costs are so expensive. I think that we need to certainly allocate greater resources. And since we are concerned about many of the carcinogenic materials down there, the compounds that are capable of causing lung scarring and fibrosis, we need to follow these patients out for 20 or 30 or 40 years, which is when we know these diseases manifest themselves. I mean, to do no less is to do in a disservice to the heroes and heroines who went down there. They didn't say, they didn't hesitate. They went down there because they felt their nation was attacked, and they deserve nothing but the best care going forward. So certainly out of $20 billion, I would hope that they could find the funds to take care of these brave men and women.
Jill, just to broaden the focus a bit, because you have done research with regard to the entire area and the possibility of people getting sick who move back prematurely to the entire financial district and even further north.
Yes. We had people who came back, induced to come back, not just because they were told that it was safe, but also they were told that we're going to give you an economic benefit, a rent, a subsidy for moving back to quite a few blocks from the World Trade Center. And these people were finding not only did they move back, but they actually walked in front of the World Trade Center site on their way to work to Wall Street. And I believe Bellevue just came out with a study on many of these residents, and it's up to four times increase in respiratory disorders than they would expect.
Again, this adds an incredible new dimension in terms of testing people, in terms of cleanup, in terms of health for larger numbers of people. We're talking people who worked in rescue and recovery and cleanup. You're talking 40,000. What could this potentially mean? What are the implications for this in terms of the wider community that may have been hurt in their health by the toxins in the entire area, in terms of what needs to be done in terms of testing, in terms of cleanup?
Well, we're asking for medical monitoring. As the good doctor pointed out, that only now, in 5 years or 10 years from now, we're going to start seeing some of these the cancers and the carcinogenic effects. But it's quite widespread, and we're going to have a workforce that's decimated. We've had already problems with lower birth rates of people in the area. So it's a question that's only been answered by denials in the city and the state.
And Dr. Moline, I know that your study didn't cover this, but what are your thoughts on the wider implications of people being affected in a wider area than just the site?
Well, you know, I like to say that dust doesn't respect city grids, and just because you weren't working on the pile doesn't mean you weren't exposed to the dust from either it being in the community or, you know, in the early days from the air patterns. I think that what we can learn from in occupational medicine is often the workers tend to be the canaries in that they have the highest exposure, and they guide us in what the health effects might be in people with lower exposure. Now, there are some buildings that suffered massive exposure, and people went back and were re-exposed and had difficulties there. Other people had extensive exposure. It might not have been high as the people working directly on the pile, but there certainly are many people in the communities who were affected, children of higher asthma rates and higher medication uses in lower Manhattan, and studies of the residents show that, in fact, many people were affected. So, I mean, we know a lot about the workers and volunteers. We know that people with the highest exposure are very sick. We also know that people who had lesser exposure are also going to be very sick. So it may not be the same proportion or the same magnitude, but many of these people's health is adversely affected, and there's no reason, there's no medical reason that they shouldn't also have monitoring programs.
And also, we had children that were brought back to schools. So we had Stuyvesant High School, we had the elementary schools right across the street, and the trucks carrying the debris away from the World Trade Center passed in front of these schools. And we also know that some of these trucks passed through Brooklyn on the way to Staten Island, passing by schools. And we've heard many problems at the Alfred Smith houses, New York City housing, NYCHA housing, in which the elderly were too frail even to close the windows. And the city just turn the other way and didn't provide them with proper health care.
Where were the Smith houses?
Right next to police headquarters.
Okay.
Well, and the city kept on saying over and over again that we can't get into residential areas because the landlords would not let us in. And in NYCHA, we know that the city was the landlord.
Joel Kufferman, Dr. Jacqueline Moline, how can people get in touch with you, people who feel that they are experiencing the symptoms and may not have known about the monitoring project at Mount Sinai? And Joel, people who feel that they would like to get on the ball and maybe prod their unions and so on to take some action around this dastardly series of negligent actions by too many officials to their grievous health issues.
For any worker or volunteer, people should either check out our website, which has information, which is www.wtcexams.org, or they can call at 1-888-702-0630 and speak to somebody and determine whether they're eligible, and we'll be able to set you up for an appointment if you are.
And the Ward Project's website is www.nyenvirolaw.org. Our phone number is 212-334-5551. And on our website, we have forms called FOIL Freedom of Information Request forms, and we urge people to use these to demand information from their government.
Joel Kufferman, Dr. Jacqueline Moline, thank you for joining us.
Thank you,
Mimi. Thank you, Ken.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. 5 years later, feel safer yet? It has been 5 years since the disaster of September 11th. And the question that must not only be posed but answered looms large before us. Do you feel safer yet? Some may quibble about the short length of time. Yo, Mo, it's only been 5 years. What do you expect so soon? Others will look at the direction that the U.S. has taken in the last 5 years, try to peer into the ominous future, and despair. For wrong roads can only lead to wrong destinations. As the smoke was still rising from the rubble of the hole in the ground in Manhattan, President George W. Bush would go before the Congress and, lifted on a cloud of evanescent political applause, announce his intention, saying, apparently, with an aside to the military, "The hour is coming when America will act and you will make us proud." 2 years later, he would make another announcement, this time described by writer Michael Peretti in his book Super Patriotism. On June 27, 2003, President Bush announced, "God told me to strike at Al-Qaeda, and I struck them. And then he instructed me to strike at Saddam, which I did. And now I am determined to solve the problem in the Middle East." God told me. He instructed me. Does it become a cause for concern that the U.S. president, sounding like an Old Testament prophet, is justifying his war policy by claiming to be in direct communication with the Almighty? The images arising from the ravaged Middle East may make you think of many things, but I doubt God is one of them. The U.S. Revolution made its mark in the world by forcefully rejecting the notion of divine right of kings. It had resonance in Europe precisely because it was an anti-royal war which sought to elevate reason as the highest authority in the state. Now we're back to the divine right of presidents. Iraq, by any measure, has been an unmitigated disaster. Voices from the right now admit this, as they hawk books promoting the splitting of Iraq into three separate states, or predict unbridled civil war. Meanwhile, if Iraq was fought to protect the homeland, a lie at any rate, it has served as a live training ground for insurgency, with graduation being the successful slaying of U.S. soldiers. Iraq, prior to September 11, 2001, was many things, but a terrorist training camp it wasn't. It is now. And it is tying both the Americans and their Iraqi puppets into knots. The question remains, do you feel safer yet? The U.S. government, from the top to the bottom, has been a parade of incompetence. Former Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge was in over his head from day one. If emergency response is any measure that the mega agency is supposed to possess, we saw its utter lack when the flood struck New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. The silence was deafening. Across the nation, there have been scandals about the theft, misuse, and misappropriation of billions, with money flowing to areas clearly unrelated to their stated purpose. It's like pigs slurping at the trough. Has Iraq, with all of its blunders, its cruelties, and its hypocrisies, made America safer, or the reverse? It's easy to be Pollyannish about this and speak of elusive successes since 9/11. Easy and deceitful. Wrong roads lead to wrong ends, and the Iraq adventure, driven less by faith than by greed and imperial arrogance, has led to repetitive disasters. America may indeed remake the world, but it won't be a world that it finds to its liking. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And you can reach us at knash@igc.org. That's knash@igc.org.